very brilliantly to overcome on all the resources that countries have, mm-hmm. from different aspects, not only from economy, even from political aspect. They try to hire some politicians, and they actually buy some politicians to do whatever they like to be done in that country. So this is the nature of these countries, these, let's say, dominating countries.
Who are we referring to exactly? Because now, you know, I think the game has changed.
Yeah.
And they are playing different games. We could see some of the countries in the Eastern world nowadays, too, that they are playing by the same rules of the West. Can we consider them as the hegemonic powers or not?
Definitely, yes. Because what we are talking about, or the countries that we are talking about, it can be, for example, the so-called superpowers that they call mm-hmm. themselves superpowers.
Yes.
And we, in our Islamic terminology, we have no superpower
okay.
except God. So these so-called superpowers, which are mostly in the West, they are not seen in the... But their traces can be seen in other parts of the world, North and in the East.
Okay.
So yes, what you said is true. You know, in the past, there were some, for example, they have divided the world between themselves, like in the old format of colonialism. They divided the world. For example, this country would be, for example, for the France, the other country would be for... let's say the United Kingdom, and the other country would be for Spain. But now, each of them, to the extent that they can, they try to suck the resources of the countries. For example, now France, for example, I'm naming the France just as an example. It can be United States at the moment for one country. Takes one part of, let's say, the industry of a country. United States takes the, for example, natural resources of that same country. And, for example, another country comes to take something else. But instead, they give nothing. It would be astonishing if you hear that, for example, in the current century that we are living, in the years that we are living in our today's life, mm-hmm. the contract that they are actually writing with the workers of those countries, give the mother country less than 3% of the right of that country.
Recently, we passed the International Day of Laborers and Labor Day. And the unfortunate news is that these laborers and laborers all around the world are getting paid lower and lower every day. And the pockets of the rich men around the world.
This is one aspect, bro. Okay. Look, paying the laborers their due is something. But what I'm talking about, I think I was not able to actually transmit the message, right? Let me tell you.
Okay.
Look, suppose that this is the next country and it has been colonized in a new format by, for example, an A country.
Okay.
So the X country naturally needs to take some profit from the country mm-hmm. that is coming to take out their resources.
That's all right.
But this mother country, this X country, receives nothing instead.
Yes. But I think that Brother Ali and Said Mohsen, it's more than that in today's world. I think such kind of etiquettes and conducts and the behaviors of the superpowers, we can say like a disease are spread now in the world. We could see in the Eastern countries too, even in the Eastern Bloc of the European countries nowadays, that they are trying also to exploit, you know, the other countries around themselves through the contracts or because exploiting their resources or something like that. Why Said Mohsen so much fond of being materialistic and being interested in this mundane world? I mean, is this the new lifestyle for today's world? You have to live in a materialistic way so you have to be alive?
Well, this is not something new, obviously, in the Quran, when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said, "Inni ja'ilun fil ardi khalifa," that I will send a khalifa on the earth, a representative on the earth. The first thing, the first objection which angels have at that time was that, are you going to send someone who shed the blood and does the corruption? So this is something which is inside human beings, because we are made of clay. And we have some part of, this material world in ourselves. Yes, we have
soul. But it doesn't mean that we have to be inclined, is it?
That's it. We have a soul and a body.
So Satan is from fire, so it doesn't have any inclination toward, I don't know, materialistic world?
It has.
He is a source of materialistic desires, brother.
It is. It has.
Okay.
But the main point is, like, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, when He created us, there is a reason of creating us.
Uh-huh.
And when he gave us the ruh or the soul, where he says, وَنَفَخْتُ فِيهِ مِنْ رُوحِي,
yes.
I have blown my ruh into him.
Yes.
It refers to the divinity and the perfection. Whereas the body that we have, it's a tool
mm-hmm.
for this soul in order to worship Allah,
okay.
in order to be a good person,
right.
and in order to be the way the soul should be. But unfortunately, those people who are like think materially, they
okay.
forget about their origin.
That's right.
They forget about the soul, that there is also a soul. Today, the world is after a peace. They cannot find peace.
Yes.
They find maybe peace in yoga. They might be find peace, maybe.
Yeah, okay.
They maybe find peace in the music, for example.
Yeah.
But still, they are not finding any peace.
They're not. Peace inside is not
yes.
possible for
today. The inside peace
okay.
is when the soul itself feels peace.
Mm-hmm. Because they do not believe in soul, brother.
There are some people like
no,
who believe
I,
and there
I
some
mean, I
who
mean
do
this
not,
system...
Yes. That's why we see
about.
The Abrahamic religion, those
yes.
who are truly following the Abrahamic
okay.
religion, and they're related to some kind of like divine
mm-hmm.
material, like you can
okay.
say like text or anything,
mm-hmm.
or worshipping.
The scriptures.
They somehow feel they have that kind of peace in them.
Mm-hmm.
Especially Muslims definitely have, because you know the Nights of Qadr and the things that we have. All these things shows us that these people have peace, even when they have less... We can say like sustenance, they at that time also thanks Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. They
That's
say thanks.
Right.
Whereas in the material world,
mm-hmm.
we see that the people, when they do not have, they complain all the time. Or if they think materially, if they think that this material world is the final destination,
mm-hmm.
you know this phrase which is like, this is the, you only have one life and just enjoy this life.
Yeah.
This is the dangerous, we can say, like, statement.
Carpe diem theory.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
okay.
this shows us that the people who are, like, thinking materially, who want to expand, they have ignored, number one.
That's right.
Number two, they have hubbud dunya.
Yes.
The love of this world.
Yeah.
Obviously, you know, if they got some power, now this is another issue. You know, sometimes when we get some power, we think, like, this is everything.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to, like, we do not want to lose that thing.
That's right.
So if America, for example, became the superpower because of the energy or the atomic bomb or the army or whatever the reason is,
okay.
because of economics,
mm-hmm.
instead of being proud of that and oppressing other countries, if it was about to help other countries to develop, it was much more, like, you know, better for the America itself, U.S., and the whole world, because when you're working for the whole world, that is, you need to obviously take everyone with yourself.
And do you think that in today's world, in the 21st century, one country can rule the others?
No, it's,
I mean,
it's not possible.
It is not like
it's
the past.
It's not possible anymore.
Okay,
it's not possible anymore, because, you know, especially with the United Nations, especially
mm-hmm.
after the World War, when
yes.
the United Nations was
established, yeah.
that was on the same basis,
okay.
that there shouldn't be any more invasion or invading countries.
Yes.
And still, that's why, you know, in the United Nations, we have the issue of Palestine and Israel.
Yes.
This Zionist regime who has occupied the Palestine,
mm-hmm.
similarly, the issue of Kashmir, that India has occupied the Kashmir. All these issues, why they
That's
are
right.
because in the United Nations
but
it was decided.
I think still the superpowers have their own lobbies in the United Nations.
Well, the point is they have veto. They have 61% of the vote.
Yeah.
That's the main issue, because
right.
they can veto
the votes.
The votes.
That's right.
And that is the main issue. If that veto is not there, then mm-hmm. obviously they do not have any power anymore.
Okay, thank you very much, Brother Ali Alavian and Said Mohsen Naqvi, for presence in the program Viewpoints. I'm Atan, the host of this program, and thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to Viewpoints on Arab English Radio Call of Islam page. For more information on this program, other programs, visit our website, parstray.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel, Call of Islam Radio. You can also refer to our Instagram page under Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Aperture.
Welcome back, everyone. In the first part, we saw how in 1951, inhabitants of a French village were suddenly tormented by terrifying hallucinations. At least 7 people died, dozens were taken to a local asylum, and hundreds were affected. Immediately, wild theories started emerging to explain this mysterious case of mass insanity. There were claims of poisoned flour, contaminated water, and even witchcraft. The truth was stranger than any of these theories. The Central Intelligence Agency had spiked the local food with LSD as part of a mind control experiment at the height of the Cold War. And with time, U.S. government's interest in LSD shifted from a defensive to an offensive orientation. While the initial experiments with LSD were fairly simple, if shockingly unethical, over time these LSD experiments grew increasingly elaborate. Stay with us as victims reveal the naked truth in the next part of this program.
Entire populations bore the consequence of large-scale tests. Here are some examples. Again, uncontested cases that are recognized by the American government. In 1953, radioactive iodine was injected into newborns and pregnant women at Iowa University and also in Nebraska. In 1955, the CIA sprayed whooping cough bacteria off the coast of Tampa. 2 died, and dozens fell ill. Also in 1955, the CIA enlisted prostitutes in San Francisco, opened 2 brothels and tested drugs on the clients, then filmed through a one-way mirror. In 1956, the Army released millions of mosquitoes carrying yellow fever and dengue on the towns of Savannah and Avon. There were several deaths and hundreds of people infected. In 1960, in Cincinnati, the Army financed a radiation program on 90 destitute or ill inhabitants of the city's University Hospital. Some died after several weeks. In 1966, the Army tested a virus in the New York Metro, then in Chicago. The bacteria was concealed in electric bulbs. The aim was to study the spread of chemical agents on a large scale. For these experiments, the Army or the CIA funded laboratories in the most prestigious universities: Yale, Stanford, Harvard, or Columbia. They all took part. Glorified by the idea of working for the nation's defense, the researchers went crazy.
Dr. Kligman in Philadelphia increases a dosage 468 times, which actually frightened Dow Chemical. They couldn't believe that a respected doctor would do that. In Washington, D.C., you had Walter Freeman, who was a very, very well-known lobotomist who traveled around the country doing lobotomies in his car. And he would use an ice pick. He could do 15 to 20 in a day. It was just incredible what some doctors did. And very few, if any, people in the hospital or the medical community blew the whistle on it. It really was an egregious act, and it showed that the medical community was more interested in protecting its ass than in protecting the test subject and the patients, because a lot of doctors went off the deep end and started doing things that are just inconceivable now.
To express his indignation, Alan Hornblum wrote half a dozen books. A former prison guard at Holmesburg in Pennsylvania, from his first day at work over 40 years ago, he had a horrible shock.
I was stunned to see scores of inmates with their shirts off, strapped and wrapped in bandages and gauze tape. And I couldn't imagine that I was going into an atmosphere that was that violent. because all of the men looked like they had just walked a cell block knife fight.
They explain that it's not because of any violence, but experiments that are carried out there. Allen was the first to denounce this scandal and would lose his job as a result.
It was probably the largest human experimentation factory in America, possibly the world. From 51 until 1974, more people were probably incorporated in more experiments than any other place in the world.
Drugs, viruses, cancerous cells, plutonium, sarin gas. The most toxic products were tested in Holmesburg, but also in dozens of prisons throughout the country. To condemn these experiments, Allen Hornblum found former inmates like Youssef. In 1961, this man was imprisoned for selling marijuana. He was poor, with limited education. He was offered a chance to take part in tests for a dollar a day. Since then, Youssef has had his digestive tract operated on. He has liver and skin problems and can no longer work. His first test was for a bath foam from the company Johnson & Johnson.
They took tape and they stuck it on your back and pulled it off, stuck it on and pulled it off until the first layer of skin came off your back. And they put six sections on my back like that. And then they took a bottle with the Johnson & Johnson bubble bath in it and put it on a patch and put the patch over the raw area. Then they took a can. I recognized that can as being from the Army. And I was like, what Johnson & Johnson got to do with this? So he took the can and he sprayed it on my back. And when it hit my back, it was cold. But it was so toxic and like fumes, I could taste it in my mouth. And as I'm walking down, I'm getting dizzier and dizzier, dizzier and dizzier. By the time I stepped into my cell, I passed out. Boom, and my back was inflamed. And by the time I woke up that morning, I had great big blisters on my back full of pus. This rash just gets worse and worse. And it looks like when the moon come out at night, it flames up and I'll be moaning and crying and moaning and crying. My cell partners couldn't sleep. We goes over there, a little shot cup, and it looked like water. We drinks it. Everything became magnified. The sound, like the loudspeaker on the system. Ooh, ooh, ooh. The walls look like they turn into water. You know what I mean? And like I spent the whole time like looking around like this here instead of doing the test. So I goes back to the block in that condition. And man, I mean, I was tripping. And it was like a slow acting drug that was in that cup. It lasts for weeks. The inmates start naming me Outer Limits. I had no conversation for nobody. I was scared of the inmates, and the inmates act like they was afraid of me.
What you had were hundreds and hundreds of uneducated minorities, overwhelmingly black and Puerto Rican. And then you had white doctors with white lab coats with PhD or MD after their name. And it was a recipe for abuse, if not disaster. And those prison walls are an ideal spot to do controversial experiments because just as those walls keep the inmates in, they also keep the public out, so no one finds out about it.
Prisoners were used, but also patients. In certain hospitals, patients were steered towards the services financed by the CIA. These services carried out limitless experiments on psychological manipulation. In 1965, Karen Wetmore was only 13 when she was admitted to a hospital in Vermont. She stayed there several times in her childhood. She suffered from severe depression after falling victim to a pedophile neighbor. Admitted against her will, she was not allowed any contact with her family. being told that it was for her own good.
The CIA was specifically looking for children between the ages of 13 and 18 to further dissociate. They wanted dissociative children. There's a sense of absolute and total helplessness. You're there, you're bound up, you're locked in this room. No matter how you scream, no matter what you say, no one is going to come. It does something to you, something you don't get over.
The doctors went to work on Karen. They wanted to erase her memory and create a robot at their command. It took 30 years of legal battles for Karen to obtain her medical records and discover the violence of the treatments she was subjected to.
It says seclusion, full cam. A cam is a straitjacket. And ties, which means they tied my arms and they tied my feet. This goes on uninterrupted, day after day, week after week, February, March, April, right up until June 21st, 1971. You sleep on the floor. On the floor. No blanket, no nothing. And my arms were secured like this, behind my back. I do remember that. It's extremely painful because it pulls on your neck, pulls on your shoulder. You can't get away from it. It's maddening is what it is. Maddening. And I was naked. And I think that was part of the effort of that experiment to break me down. Everything they did was to break me down.
Months in a confined room with no bearings, while her captors administered all kinds of drugs and sometimes electric shocks at inhuman levels.
Number of shocks and the seconds that they held the shocks. They had 30, 30, 35, 35, 35, and they held it for sustained for 40 seconds. A normal shock would be a second. Certainly not 30 and 35 of them. One, not that many, which probably is what obliterated my memory right there. And I think that's the way they did it. That's the way they did it. They also said, in this treatment right here, no seizure, shock restarted, so they gave me a second one. Because they couldn't produce a seizure. So they must have done it over again. Must have repeated it. It's unforgivable. And I'm sure I wasn't the only one they did this to. I'm sure. I survived to be able to talk about it.
How many suffered similar experiments? In Montreal, Canada, the CIA used a world-renowned psychiatrist to set up a factory of guinea pigs in the Allen Memorial Psychiatric Department in McGill University. This psychiatrist was Ewan Cameron, one of the all-powerful presidents of the World Psychiatric Association. In 1945, Ewan Cameron made the acquaintance of Rudolf Hess, one of the Nazis accused in the Nuremberg trial. In 1957, the CIA recruited him for their MK-Ultra program. The Americans wanted to perfect their interrogation techniques and program a human to kill. Ewan Cameron became the mad dog of psychiatry. He put his patients in vegetative states for several weeks while bombarding them with pre-recorded orders. Some would become incontinent, amnesiac, forgetting even who their parents were and how to speak. The Vermont hospital where Karen Wetmore was confined was working on the same program. In the hands of the CIA doctors, she was like a rag doll.
They used drugs like LSD. They used electric shock. They used chemical shock agent metrazole, which I was given in 1971. And I found that out in my medical records, which is a very brutal drug, very brutal drug. CIA said it was excruciating physically and emotionally, excruciating drug. I have a quote from the CIA that said that the Soviets used it in the gulags, and that a POW would say or do anything to avoid a second dose. Nice drug.
There's all kinds of people who believe and people who don't believe, and that's a debate about do you believe or don't believe. I'm always interested in what are in the documents saying. So the documents clearly describe implanting electrodes in people's brains, activating the electrode from a remote transmitter, and changing the person's behavior from angry, pounding the wall, sitting there just staring.
Behind Karen's ear is a scar, and she doesn't know what it's from.
Once my therapist really understood that I had really been experimented on by the CIA, she said to me, you know, just for the heck of it, let me look. Because we'd heard about, we'd read about, there's been information about these implants. And I'm like, okay. And it was there, actually there. There's this, I showed you. I went to a plastic surgeon who told me it was a surgical scar. But there's nothing in my medical history, nothing in a medical record that shows any kind of problem ever behind my right ear, or any incision or any surgery or anything else. But there it is.
What stopped the journey down this destructive path? In 1973, while Watergate is rattling all the institutions, Richard Helms, director of the CIA, feels the winds of change. He works as a lone wolf and hasn't informed the president of these experiments. He knows he's crossed the line. To protect himself, he orders the destruction of all documents relating to the MKUltra program and its abandonment. 2 years later, in 1975, the President Gerald Ford orders an inquiry into the CIA. The Rockefeller Commission is sworn in. The task isn't simple, because at the heart of the CIA, even Richard Helms' close lieutenants know nothing about the brainwashing programs.
There's a lot of goofy things to go on in a big agency like that with all that secrecy. Things can go on that you don't know about, that the people who are working for the director most closely don't know about, or that the director doesn't know about. I mean, they're keeping it quiet down there. You don't tell anybody. If it works, then we'll tell them. But, you know, in the meantime, don't get into any difficulties. I remember when they wanted to take a kitty cat and stick a microphone up its rear end and put an antenna on its ear and have him walk in where we spy in the park with another one, walk over and walk around and listen in on it. You know, they tried it one time in an experiment, and a taxi came by and ran over the cat. You know, so.
In reality, nothing is funny. In its haste to get rid of evidence, the CIA forgets 20,000 documents. A drop of water compared to the amount that was destroyed, but they reveal that it financed 149 programs, implicating 80 institutions, including the most respected. Called on to justify themselves, the heads of the CIA, like Dr. Lashbrook, lie and downplay the facts.
There was, of course, claims or thoughts that maybe great things could be done with hypnosis. One small project in which we had a hypnotist do some experiments, primarily to see what the limitations of hypnosis might be. Can you make a person do something under hypnosis that he would not ordinarily do?
Even if the head of the CIA, Richard Helms, tried to minimize the scale of the experiments, the victims' testimonies contradict him.
The next thing I remember,
the inquiry commissions follow, each reaching more and more witnesses, like this woman, Chris DeNicola. Her father put her in the hands of a reputed CIA doctor, Dr. Green, when she was 12 years old.
His objective was to gain control of my mind and train me to be a spy assassin. Dr. Green had electrodes on my body, including my head. He used what looked like an overhead projector and repeatedly said he was burning different images into my brain, while a red light flashed aimed at my forehead. In between each sequence, he used electric shock on my body and told me to go deeper and deeper, while repeating each image would go deeper into my brain, and I would do whatever he told me to do. Dr. Green moved on to wanting me to kill dolls that looked like real children.
Inquiry reports that resulted from these terrifying testimonies revealed one thing for certain. The experiments ended in disaster. In its insane quest for a robot human or a truth serum, the CIA failed. On August 3, 1995, with the revelations mounting up, then-President Bill Clinton makes a public apology. Since then, a great number of secret archives have been released to the public domain. Researchers would take an interest in this troubled period, notably Hank Albarelli, who worked on the suspicious death of Frank Olson, the biochemist who worked at the heart of the CIA. Since 1951, the year of the Pont Saint-Esprit incident, Frank Olson called into question the ethics of the experiments being carried out and became depressed as a result. In November 1953, the CIA put LSD into his glass without him knowing. 9 days later, he threw himself off the 13th floor of a New York hotel. Murder or suicide, we'll never know. At the time of the investigation, Hank Albarelli found a surprising document coming from the White House. It surprisingly linked the name of Frank Olson to Pont Saint-Esprit. Why, in the middle of the Korean War, would the White House be interested in this small French village? Even better, Hank also came across a study carried out by the CIA on LSD.
The document itself was a comprehensive overview or history, if you will, of LSD specifically, yes. Not on ergot, had nothing to do with ergot. There was a section or chapter, if you will, headed incident at Pont Saint-Esprit. And the first two paragraphs of that describe essentially what we've all read, you know, many times over in terms of what happened at Pont Saint-Esprit. But the remainder of that section, the rest of that page, which was about half the page, and the two pages that followed, were completely blocked out.
Above all was this damning document from the CIA. It dates from 1953 and has no doubt been declassified by mistake. A director at Sandoz Laboratories confirmed to a secret agent that the Pont Saint-Esprit incident was caused by LSD. Sandoz Laboratories was where Albert Hoffman worked, the man who discovered LSD. It even claimed the drug was responsible for the Pont Saint-Esprit tragedy, before recanting. This same document states that in 1952, the source at the CIA had already explained that the cursed bread was caused by LSD. Did French authorities try to silence the affair? Several years after the drama, a head of the Victims Association was shocked at how disinterested the investigators were. Do the French have something to hide? We've interrogated former members of the Secret Services, investigated national and regional archives, as well as those from the police and the Justice Department. The files are hard to find, and many important pieces, such as reports from main hearings, have disappeared. If America revealed unwillingly some of its secrets about its participation in the poisoning, the uncertainties over the involvement of the French authorities may yet go on for some years longer. It takes 75 years for some sensitive documents to be made public. Hidden in its small streets and stone buildings, the Pont Saint-Esprit drama has yet to reveal all its secrets.
Well,
Judging from the CIA's dark and notorious past of misconduct, perhaps it'll be no surprise if horrific clandestine high-tech experiments are being carried out somewhere in the world by the CIA at this very moment. Secrets that we must wait 75 years to be declassified, if ever disclosed to the public at all. And that's everyone for this week on Aperture. It's goodbye.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, illegitimate property. Islam cares not only about the results, but also about how the results are achieved. Those who are content with their good deeds, but do not think about the means by which they perform the good deeds, neglect this reality that none of them is accepted by God, unless the means are pure and sacred. Imam Muhammad Baqir, the fifth infallible Imam, has said, "Whenever a man gains a property in an illegitimate way, neither his Hajj and Umrah performed with that property is accepted, nor the uniting of kindred." Brothers and sisters, usurpation means that a person unjustly seizes the property or right of another person. This is one of the major sins, and one who commits it will be subjected to severe chastisement on the Day of Judgment. It has been reported from the Holy Prophet, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, that whoever usurps one span of another's land, seven layers of that land will be put round his neck like a yoke on the Day of Judgment. Now, similar traditions that are there, they are to inform us of something that is going to be a natural outcome of our action. Allah doesn't want this to happen, hence Allah and His Prophet and Ahlul Bayt, they keep making us afraid of that situation. They want the believers and Muslims at large to be saved from these terrible punishments and chastisement. But if we pay no attention to the words of Quran and Allah and Imams and Prophet, then of course, you know, there's no other choice but for us to face these chastisements. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing the topic of illegitimate property. And, you know, one of the sins that unfortunately is prevalent in the world today, generally speaking, is usurpation of other people's properties. It happens at the level of individuals, at the level of communities, and even the countries. Look at Palestine, for instance, right? It has been usurped, it has been occupied by the Zionists. Now, in Islam, the concept of ownership is treated with utmost care. The properties that are capable to be owned are well-defined and specified. Likewise, the rights of the owner over such property are stipulated in the Sharia law as well. The Sharia also affords
its protection by laying down rules and regulations so that owners and other individuals would be guided and will not abuse the power and authority thereby accorded to them. So if you look at Islam, Islam wants to protect the rights of everyone, not just a select group. Unfortunately, some other religions, it has come down to them protecting the rights of a very select group of elites. But Islam, it wants to make sure, and it wishes to make sure, and it does make sure that the rights of all the individuals are protected. And when the government of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is going to be established, this very notion is going to be witnessed by the whole world. Yes, at the moment we may be falling short on some aspects of it, but generally speaking, we know that Islam is a proponent of the rights of every single person, and nobody has a right to occupy anybody else's property. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Iran and the remaining signatories to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action are continuing their talks in Vienna to save the nuclear agreement nearly 3 years after Washington's unilateral withdrawal in 2018. The United States is complicating the negotiations by insisting on keeping in place 500 anti-Iran sanctions, including in the 2015 nuclear deal, officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA. Informed sources say if kept in place, the sanctions on these 500 individuals and entities will prevent Iran from doing business with the rest of the world, which is in violation of Article 29 of the agreement. This is while Tehran has time and again reiterated that Washington has to take the first step towards reviving the nuclear deal by unconditionally removing all sanctions in a verifiable manner.
It has been the United States who left the JCPOA, who withdrew from the JCPOA. It is the United States who should come first, who should implement its obligations and lift all of its sanctions. And then Iran would verify, and after open verification, Iran would restart its obligations in the JCPOA.
Tehran has also reiterated its calls that the United States has to remove not some, but all sanctions on the Islamic Republic.
Well, our position is quite clear. All sanctions should be lifted. All sanctions which are mentioned in the JCPOA, and any new sanctions imposed after the adoption day of the JCPOA, including everything during Trump administration. This is our position, is quite clear, and we are working to come to a conclusion which meet our demands on the sanctions lifting area.
The comments by Araghchi comes as the JCPOA has been in disarray since May 2018, when former U.S. President Donald Trump abandoned the deal and reimposed the anti-Iran sanctions that the JCPOA had removed. The Trump administration has also placed additional sanctions on Iran under other pretexts not related to Iran's nuclear energy program as part of its maximum pressure campaign. The negotiations in Vienna come as the new U.S. administration has expressed readiness to compensate for Trump's mistake and rejoin the deal. It is, however, showing an overriding willingness to maintain some of the sanctions as a tool of pressure. Many believe that the U.S. refusal to remove anti-Iran sanctions would mean the talks are about to fail or have already failed.
I think that we are in a very important situation right now. We will know in the coming days whether the talks will succeed or in fact fail. And the pressure is currently on Washington, because while the Iranian government stands firmly together in their refusal to renegotiate agreements that have been in the works for years now, the American side is completely disorganized, and it's not sure whether President Biden will remain the majority leader in both houses of Congress for the foreseeable future.
Some also believe that there is a possibility that the U.S. will resort to the old tactic of agreeing to a nuclear deal with all of its benefits on paper, yet intimidate other countries from doing business with Iran using the threat of sanctions like it did during the 2015 nuclear agreement. Iran says it will not allow the negotiations to become attritional. Iran's top negotiator in Vienna and Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi says the Islamic Republic would stop the negotiations if it concludes that the other side lacks seriousness, tries to buy time, or seek to add new topics to those under discussion. Iran says the ball is now in the U.S.'s court to return to the agreement and remove all sanctions on Tehran or pursue the failed policy of its predecessor known as Maximum Pressure Campaign and push ahead with its hostile policy against the Islamic Republic. The Biden administration has so far not taken any solid measure to return to the deal over 100 days after it took the helm in Washington. The next 2 weeks will be decisive, and the negotiations could go either way. More attacks by Israeli forces against Palestinians in the occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds. On Monday, over 300 Palestinians were wounded after Israeli troops fired rubber bullets on them around the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Scores were detained by Israeli forces. The protests erupted after Israeli troops stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in an effort to force out the Palestinians. The violence around the mosque and the Old City were the worst since 2017, fueled by a years-long bid by Israeli settlers to take over Palestinian homes in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. The Israeli regime is also celebrating its 1967 occupation of Jerusalem al-Quds.
There are several facts here. One is that this is a process of, once again, of ethnic cleansing in broad daylight. It is a provocation, obvious provocation against Islam, and has appropriately been denounced by most Arab countries, including a couple of them who were overly anxious to normalize relations with Israel and hopefully will now reconsider what they've done.
Sheikh Ikrimah Sabri, the imam and preacher of Al-Aqsa Mosque, has condemned the attack, calling the raid a heinous crime that cannot be tolerated. Leader of the Palestinian National Initiative Party, Mustafa Barghouti, called the Israeli raid on Al-Aqsa Mosque compound a criminal act. Barghouti described the raid as a racist act by an apartheid regime.
Well, Israel is indisputably an apartheid state. It always has been from the outset, from 1948 on. It simply wasn't called that. The apartheid nature of Israel was confirmed in 1967 when it invaded the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem. Mustafa Barghouti is absolutely 100% right when he calls it a criminal act.
The military brigade of the Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, also warned against the presence of Israeli forces in the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The situation is so fluid, and resistance movements fired tens of rockets toward occupied Palestine Monday afternoon. The clashes in Al-Aqsa Mosque have drawn widespread condemnation from the international community. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres urged Israel to cease demolitions and evictions, saying Israeli authorities must exercise maximum restraint. The U.S. government, however, stopped short of condemning the Israeli aggression against Palestinians. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan instead conveyed serious concern to his Israeli counterpart about violent confrontations in Jerusalem al-Quds. Arab nations, including Syria, Iraq, and Qatar, also hit out at Israel over the Jerusalem violence. Some Arab countries, including those that last year normalized relations with Israel, condemned the Israeli aggression. Iran, Pakistan, and many other nations also slammed the attack. In Britain, Germany, Turkey, Jordan, and elsewhere, people took to the streets to condemn the Israeli regime's atrocities and voice solidarity with the Palestinian people. In some countries, like Oman, people gathered in front of the Israeli embassy to condemn the raids.
It's clear, I think, to the peoples of the world, even if it's not necessarily to political classes in the Occident, in the West, that the Israeli regime is a criminal entity, and what they're seeing practiced against the Palestinian people, Palestinian worshippers, which is really the reflection of a process that's gone on for far too long and backed by Western governments, specifically Washington and its allies. So there's no surprise in the fact that people everywhere in the world are outraged.
The Israeli desecration of the Al-Aqsa Mosque is nothing new. Israel has done similar acts in the past many times. Tel Aviv has been violating the rights of Palestinians with impunity since its installment in the region by its Western creators. The regime enjoys full support from the U.S. in particular.
The reason that Israel was created in the first place was that it was meant to be a foothold for British expansion into the region and to the control of oil and gas, natural gas resources in the region.
What is clear is the fact that the Israeli aggression against Palestinians cannot end through dialogue. Israel has defied calls to stop violating the rights of Palestinians for decades. Many factions in Palestine have also come to the conclusion that Israel can be pushed back only through resistance, and that any effort short of resistance will come to nothing given Washington's all-out support for the Israeli regime at the UN Security Council, the only world body that can issue a binding resolution against the regime.
People of Palestine have long suffered aggression at the hands of Israel, but that escalated to epic proportions in this Ramadan. The regime launched a crackdown on Palestinian worshippers and restricted their gatherings in the old city of Jerusalem al-Quds during the Muslim holy month. Later in the month, an Israeli court ruled that over a dozen Palestinian families must leave their homes in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in East Jerusalem al-Quds immediately, despite having lived there for generations. The eviction order sparked several protests in the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip. The crackdown on ensued injured hundreds of Palestinians. It also drew condemnations from the international community against Israel, with even the Arab countries that have recently normalized ties with the regime, namely Sudan, the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain, denouncing the Israeli forces' storming of the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
It's not only the general oppression of Israel, but Israel got very aggressive with the district of Jerusalem, Sheikh Jarrah, where they want to get rid of all the remaining Palestinian families. The Israelis, I think, did not anticipate what they were stepping into when they chose to evict all of these families at the same time in the month of Ramadan.
The United Nations Human Rights Office urged Israel to cease the eviction order immediately. It said, "The transfer of parts of an occupying power's civilian population into the territory that it occupies is prohibited under international humanitarian law and may amount to a war crime." Israel has been trying to downplay the recent clashes, with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu strongly rejecting international pressure not to build settlements in Jerusalem al-Quds.
"We also firmly reject the pressures not to build in Jerusalem. To my regret, these pressures have been increasing of late. I say also to the best of our friends, Jerusalem is Israel's capital, and just as every nation builds in its capital and builds up its capital, we also have the right to build in Jerusalem and to build up Jerusalem. That is what we have done, and that is what we will continue to do."
But under international law, all Israeli settlements are deemed illegal. The United Nations Security Council has condemned Israel's settlement building activities in the occupied territories in several resolutions. Jerusalem al-Quds remains at heart of a decades-long conflict, with Palestinians insisting that East al-Quds, illegally occupied by Israel since 1967, must serve as the capital of a Palestinian state. In the meantime, the Al-Aqsa Mosque has had enormous significance throughout the years. In the year 2000, an Israeli official's visit to the holy site provoked a Palestinian uprising known as the Second Intifada. Observers say the recent escalation of violence surrounding the Al-Aqsa Mosque could be a prelude to a third intifada.
"As far as I'm concerned, an intifada is always possible in Palestine. The Israelis are putting more and more pressure. They're hoping to keep the pressure at just the right level to cause, to motivate the ethnic cleansing, the expulsion of the Palestinians, the marginalization of the Palestinians, without having it explode completely."
Emboldened by former U.S. President Donald Trump's all-out support, Israel has stepped up its aggression against the Palestinian people. But with Trump gone, for how long can it keep on committing its crimes?
The coronavirus pandemic has struck a heavy blow against major economies across the globe. Many people have lost their jobs or seen their income